now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we'll be talking with Maggie Cullinan, director of the Charlottesville Victim Witness Program, and Jeff Leonard, who's senior probation officer at District 9 Probation and Parole, and also one of the stakeholders in this radio station, about victims' rights on this, which is National Victims' Rights Week. Welcome, Maggie.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeff. So, Maggie, you're a victim witness coordinator. And I remember when I was a young defense attorney, and I would go
to
court. And I, yes, you did. And I would see that there was a, I would be like, what is a victim witness coordinator? What, tell us a little bit about what you do.
Well, I guess our job is to kind of help coordinate the criminal justice system for the victim. I think anybody, you know, and you know as a defense attorney, anybody who gets involved in the criminal justice system, it's a massive, confusing situation.
Mm-hmm.
So for the defendant, for the victim, and most people base their views of the criminal justice system on CSI or SVU, which is not anywhere close to what the reality is.
My wife gets mad at me when we watch, like, you know, movies about court cases. I'm like, they can't do that.
Yeah, and it doesn't end in an hour. It just
never ends.
And the forensics, you know, take about, you know, 10 months to come back. So, yeah. So that's what the view that they have. So basically, it's kind of orienting them. This is how it's going to go. This is how it's going to go or not going to go.
Mm-hmm.
These are realistic expectations.
Right.
This is where you get to have your input. You know, we want to hear what you want to happen. So it's basically walking them through a process now. In a misdemeanor case, the process may be a day.
Right.
But in a felony or a homicide case, that we may be with them for a couple of years.
Right. Now, that makes sense. And so you are mostly dealing with the person who is the victim of the crime.
Well,
assuming it's not a homicide.
Yeah. And if it's a homicide, it's a family.
Right.
Family members. And yeah, we're dealing with the victim. Sometimes they are fully participating victims. Sometimes they're victims who don't want anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's working with them at that level as well.
Right. Well, you've been involved with a number of high profile cases, like the Jesse Matthews case, I think, that your office was
initially
involved with.
Yes.
Some other things of that nature. You do everything from those, you know, sort of massive headline grabbers down to an individual who's,
right,
you know, been struck by their spouse, mm-hmm, during a marital spat or something
or
of that nature.
Credit card fraud or
credit card fraud.
Whole spectrum. Yeah.
Tell me about credit card. When I think about, you know, victim witness, I think of domestic violence and sex crimes.
Yeah.
And maybe homicide, but usually the ones that grab the headlines are the homicides related to sex crimes. But
But day to day, we deal with a lot of different victims. You know, the thing about being a victim is that whether you're a victim of a breaking and entering, a petty larceny, a grand larceny, or a domestic, it throws off your worldview. This is the way I thought the world worked.
Right.
This is the way I thought things were going to go. And now somebody broke into my house. I'm never going to feel safe in my house again. I had locks on the door. People stole my stuff. People went through my underwear drawer. I mean, these are basic safety, you know, and how you operate in the world. So people get thrown off that way. And, you know, it's our job to try to help them reorient, you know, and go through the criminal justice system to try to repair that, if that's possible, which mostly it's not possible, but
sort of sounds like a counseling kind of
it
oriented.
Is. I mean, I have a master's in counseling, and it is a lot of crisis intervention, talking people off their ledge or mm-hmm wherever they are, just to try to reorient them to their life and as they walk through the criminal justice system, which is nothing like real life.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, it's just nothing. It doesn't make sense most of the time.
So you also provide some services, which are very helpful, I think, to the Commonwealth attorneys in terms of you help them sort of arrange the witness interviews and kind of communicate among
I mean, this position came out, you know, these positions came out like 20 years ago with the victims' rights movement because the system wasn't set up for victims. there, you know, for years, we still concentrate. It's the rights of the defendant. We want to make sure the right person goes to jail and all their rights are met. And if their rights are not met, then they can appeal the hell out of it. Well,
I agree. Yeah. I think that is entirely correct.
Right. Well, if you're a victim and you feel like you've been screwed, you got no rights. You can't appeal anything. So, you know, the state enacted a Bill of Rights. So, but they're not enforceable. You know, and I think most Commonwealth attorneys, and mine certainly, pay attention to that. It's, you know, you have the right. We're not going to make any decisions about the case without informing you. We're not going to have a case motion without letting you know. Mm-hmm. We're going to try to make you feel safe. We're trying to get restitution.
So basically notice of the proceedings.
Yeah.
Consultation.
Yes.
About case decisions.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned restitution.
Yes. Restitution. You know, I don't know, but basically making sure they feel safe through the process and after the process.
Gathering medical records.
Yeah, I mean, well, see, there's a conception because we are in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office that we are like paralegals for the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, which is not true. I mean, in the county, their victim witness person is in the police department.
Right.
So they work. We are in a building that has the Commonwealth Attorney's Office and the police department, so mm-hmm. we work with both. Commonwealth Attorney, we're attached to them, and we help them wrangle the witnesses or mm-hmm. set up, you know, that's our job. But quite honestly, we don't always agree with what the Commonwealth attorney wants to do with the case.
No.
Or,
no.
Yes,
that can't
you know,
be.
They have their job. I mean, their job is to prosecute the case and make sure that the state of Virginia is prosecuting this person for violating the rules of the state of Virginia.
Right.
The victim is just a byproduct of that.
Mm-hmm.
The victim is a witness to somebody violating the rules of the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
that's why the Commonwealth is the party.
Yeah.
Not
and,
the
you
victim.
Know, people are confused about that when they come
yes.
in. Who's my lawyer?
Right.
Well, it's not really your lawyer. They're going to do what the Commonwealth thinks is right for the safety of the community, which
right.
is their job. That may not always be what the victim wants
right.
or needs. So I'm there to make sure that the victim's wishes are articulated.
That they're heard.
They're heard.
And considered.
And considered. And a lot of the times, you know, it's the same thing. They go, it's the same thing. But sometimes it's not. You know, I've had my conflicts where I'd say, you know, you can't do that to that victim or that's not okay. That's not going to help her recover. You know,
right.
this is damaging to her. But you know, that's what I'm there
sort of
for.
You're sort of a voice for the victims in the process with the Commonwealth, not with the court, but with the Commonwealth.
No, not with the court, really. I mean, although I have had, you know, and as my position doing this for 8 or so years, I have had opportunities to talk to judges about what they say from the bench and how that impacts victims. Because we have judges who, you know, rightly so, when they're sentencing somebody, they say, you know, listen, I've looked at the pre-sentence report. You know, you have a lot going on for you. I know you can turn your life around, make the best you can in what you got in your couple of years, and go on and live a productive life. Well, the victim's family sitting over there, and it's a sex offense against their 11-year-old daughter.
Right.
And when they walk out of that courtroom, they're like, what?
Why you know, was he patting that guy on the back?
Why was he right. You know, and a judge can do both. And that judge had no idea. Like he wasn't
well, he
really
patted
good.
Him on the back and gave him 20 years in prison.
Well,
so
no, that particular case, it was like two or three.
I'll lop off some of the prison sentence in exchange for the back pat.
We
can negotiate
that
this.
It doesn't work that much in Charlottesville, honestly. In my perspective.
You should have an adult warning content. There will be some discussion of some mature nature on this radio station for the next hour. So please, if the wee ones are there, you might want to send them outside to play. It's a beautiful day.
Yeah, well, I mean, my point was my job is to make sure that the victim's voice is heard and that the process is better for them.
Mm-hmm.
So by having that discussion with that judge, he was just, I had no idea. You know, so now that particular judge is somewhere else, but
which judge you mean.
Yes. And he would say, listen, you know, this was a horrible thing that happened to this victim's family. You know, we want to recognize that, the damage, and then he would go on and say what he wants to say.
Right.
So at least it was more equitable and hopefully had a better experience.
Sort of the goal of that was to kind of help with the emotions of the victim and the victim's family and
mm-hmm.
sort of sitting in that courtroom.
Yeah.
And
it's the aftermath.
Hearing the authorities speak.
Right. I think a lot of people think, well, I'm going to get my day in court and I'm going to feel better afterwards. And it just does not work that way.
Yeah.
And I try to tell people that, like the homicide victims in particular, because it takes a couple of years to get to court. And they're like, you know, once we get to court and we get, And they never feel better afterwards. They might feel it's ended for now.
But right.
They delay their pain to that point. They delay dealing with it to that point. And it never goes
well. That is a counseling perspective.
Yeah.
That's one of the aspects of my job that I'm not so hot at. I'm really good at the, I'm going to put the evidence in. I'm going to cross-examine the hell out of somebody. I'm not, my bedside manner sucketh.
You can refer them to a counselor.
Right. That's not my job. I go, okay, well, you know.
Right.
Here's what we can do with your case. Now, go talk about your feelings with this person.
Right, exactly. Right. Well, that's our job, too, is to refer out to community services. There are people in the community that will work with these people if they're ready to do it. So,
yeah, but you do have more of a counsel-y sort of.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, I have a realistic view of the criminal justice system because I worked here with my friend Jeff for 7 years as a probation officer.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. And before that, I worked 4 years at the shelter. So
So you've got a wide array of experience, years of experience.
Yeah, I don't know how many victim witness people actually spend a lot of time with defendants. I did, and I supervise sex offenders and domestic violence offenders. So, and I also know that a lot of those defendants or probationers are victims, you know, and people come through my office as a victim one time and as a defendant the next.
How do you deal with that just emotionally yourself? You're engaging with these people. As an attorney, one of the things that's easy for me is I can just go, nope, we're not having that emotional engagement. We're not doing it. Here's your case. Yeah. Ba, 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 ba. But I just don't go there, right? But your job is partly to go there. So how do you deal with that aspect of things? You know, you've got a victim and you've got a defendant, and you know, since you're the advocate for the victim and you know, not the one defending the guy or the guy trying the case, your viewpoint is this happened, this person did this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you know that person because they were victimized 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that emotionally?
I can get very black and white on that. So when I'm in that position, you know, it's easy for me to say, I may be in my head, mm-hmm. you know, I know what's going on there. I know that guy was sexually assaulted as a child or whatever, but my position is to be there with the victim, you know, and to empathize with their feelings and this isn't right. And, you know, that's where I am.
So that way, it's a little like my job in that, you know, your focus is on that victim in that case right there. And that's the perspective you align with.
Yeah.
And my focus ethically has to be on this is my defendant and this is where mm-hmm. I'm going to align in this process. And I just can't go there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think we have in that way we are similar. And that's probably one of the few ways we are similar as far as, you know, dealing with our jobs. You know, I think there's a perception from some of the defense community that we witness people, you know, hate defense attorneys and they're evil.
Well, you don't hate us. Some of us are kind of evil.
There are a few. I will say, you know, but I think if you're in this job long enough and you've seen it, you know, they're doing their job and hopefully well, and it's part of the system.
And hopefully we know you're doing your job.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and you can have, you know, defense attorneys make sure that the criminal justice system does things better. You know, they have to work harder if they're working up against a good defense. I mean, that's the whole idea. That's the way the system works.
It's an adversary system, right?
Yes. Yes, it is. It's an adversary system that just doesn't consider the victim very much or can't because
of the system. I think it's changed a lot over recent years. It has in the time I've been practicing. I mean, I graduated
there's more programs and things like that.
Law school in 96. And over the, you know, so it's been about 20 years. Over that span of time, I have seen a big change in terms of
victim-centered
mm-hmm. kind of view of the system.
Yeah, there is a view of it. And hopefully we're moving in that direction. But it's a very, like anything in the criminal justice system with change, it's very slow.
Courts are glacial.
Or, yes, they are glacial. And
right.
In some courts in particular. So.
Well, so Jeff, turning to you for a moment, you're a probation officer. I think of you
on the good days, yes, ma'am.
As working with offenders.
About time you had me on your show, by the way. Thanks.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I thought long and hard about it, but I don't think of you as somebody who works with victims, but I understand you received an award recently for outstanding service to victims of crime in Central Virginia. Tell me about that.
Margaret Cullinan presented me with that award.
No.
Simply.
What?
Okay, adult content warning. Put the children out of the room. So, I got an award.
We're okay, as long as you don't say any four-letter words.
Well, you never know. So, I don't have the delay button on today.
That's bad.
So, I got this award. I was all proud. Me and my partner at the time, Phil Holly, State Trooper Phil Holly, got an award.
I know Trooper Holly.
He's a great guy. We run the sex offender registry for basically from Short Pump Mall to the top of Afton Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And working with victims is real. People, like you said, you don't think about it, but when people go to prison, typically someone they have sexually assaulted against, they know or have a pre-existing relationship. So when someone gets out of prison, one of our roles and jobs is to reach out if the victim is still willing to talk to us or still in the area or still alive. We reach out to them, make contact with them, give them our cell phones, give them our information to say, hey, this guy's out. If he represents any threat to you, any danger to you, because 95% of the time they're going to have no contact orders.
Mm-hmm.
So I reach out to the victim. I say, hey, if you have contact with this individual, you do two things. You dial 911 and then you call my cell phone,
mm-hmm,
in that order. So we are able to, one, document where, when, and how, so that if a violation is required, then we can do a violation. And the police get involved for their safety and to have a permanent record, as the police will fill out a report. So, pardon me, the allergy gods are striking me. So Maggie, or someone, nominates me and Trooper Holly for this award. And I'm on cloud nine. I'm the happiest. I'm so proud. I'm so happy. I'm humbled. Thanks. But it turned into the most impactful, memorable day of my 20-some year career, not because of the award I got, but because of the circumstances by which it was presented. So I got the award. Phil Holly got the award. I think one of the federal prosecutors got an award. John Zug got an award. Clerk of the Court John Zug, former guest on Straight Talk with Andre Hicks. So we're there, and it's in city council chambers, and it's packed. The media's there, the federal, you know, U.S. attorney's there. There's a lot of people there. And I've got my speech ready because I know I got to give a little, mm-hmm, talk. And so the first person to speak is this victim of sexual abuse who told a story of her father coming into her room every night, starting when she was like 6 years old until she left the house at 18. And she's a bit of a, and she's at an okay place with it where she can go out and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the way she presented it was, and Maggie and I and, you know, Denise Lunser was there and Zug was there and people who do this hard stuff for a living were all there, and everybody was in tears. It was, I'm getting chills saying, but it was unbelievable how impactful that lady, that victim's story was. And it didn't exactly happen like this, but in my mind it happened like this. So I'm there, I'm crying uncontrollably, and then Maggie goes, and now here's Jeff Leonard with his award.
Ah!
I was like, you gotta be kidding me. How am I? So I get up there, and I stumble, and I say, I don't know what to say. TV lot loud, thank you. And I sit down. I was like, what was that?
Boo-hoo.
But I'm still crying. I'm wiping tears off my face. So that lady, who is one of my heroes. I mean, the fact that she's able to come to some place with her victimization to come out and teach me and teach Maggie and teach everybody else in that room that and make us feel good about what we do, that is something I will remember forever. You were crying.
I don't cry. I was not crying. I had to get up and speak. One of the things I remember most about that event was he was probably 40 years old before she decided she wanted to report to the police. And this was up in Roanoke area. And they worked with her, and she called her dad on the phone.
Oh, and yeah, it's just one of those setup phone calls.
Yes, it was. You know, and their dad at the time was like 70 years old.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So
what happens in these phone calls is that there's a recording, right? There's the officers there. The phone call's being made from a phone at the police department.
Yep.
The line is recorded.
Yeah.
The victim or complainant, as we in the defense trade like to say, has been, you know, sort of coached about how to do this. And then they have they get the alleged offender on the line, and they basically confront them about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal, I think, is to have the offender say, "I'm so sorry, I never meant to hurt you." And then they have basically a confession.
Well, yeah, I will say though, in this victim's view, she would have wanted to have that conversation with him anyway.
I'm sure
she was at the point where, okay, I'm ready to deal with it. I need to let you know that I know what happened. And it, you know, it did happen, and he confessed, and they did put him in prison.
Right.
And it, because it happened before 1995, when parole
was abolished.
Yeah, so he comes up for parole every couple of years,
right.
And she has to go to the parole board and talk about her impact. One of the things she said, though, was she was able to articulate what it felt like to be a victim going through that process as a child being victimized, and then as an adult going through the criminal justice process. And she was able to give, I guess, a really good pep talk to the police officers and probation officers and prosecutors in that room to say, you know, we recognize what you do is really hard. And I appreciate what you do. There's plenty of other people that appreciate what you do. And, you know, I don't think they hear that enough. You know, especially people who work sex crimes, because a lot of people are like, "Oh, sex crimes! I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to know about it."
Really, from a defense perspective, it always seems like, you know, I am the bad guy, right? Because how can, you know, the cocktail party question every defense attorney gets, and God forbid you do sex crimes, is, you know, how can you defend somebody that you know is guilty?
It's called the Constitution.
You know, and the answer is, it's my job,
right?
You know, and I do my ever-loving job, and you know, I don't permit myself to consider that. But implicit in that question is this sort of assumption that, you know, people who are accused of this are guilty. And I would think that the prosecutors and the victim witness people and the police officers involved in these cases would get a lot of kudos and a lot of support for doing that work. Is it not that way?
I don't see it that way.
Doesn't seem like that.
You're dealing with, and you know, Maggie's been in the military and working around police officers. I'm certain she'll back me in this. Is that it's sort of an old boy network. It's sort of, oh, this stuff doesn't get to me. You know, there's no sort of crisis debriefing. There's no, you know, you live every day in other people's worst day. You know,
Jeff, it doesn't get to me either. Ever.
So, and that's, you know, that's why you and I are friends. Maggie and I are friends is because we share this commonality that our spouses don't understand. Because when you go home, you can't talk. I mean, if I went home to my wife, which I do occasionally, and tell you a little bit about what happened in the day, it would depress her beyond belief, because the carnage in which we dwell. So we rely on each other. We rely on defense attorneys. We rely on victim witness, police, prosecutors, to have that commonality to go through this, to sort of support each other.
I think Charlottesville is sort of unique. The bar is a little unique in that collegiality. In other areas of the state, I don't think that's as much the case. But most of the prosecutors here, you know, I know and like personally.
Well, we've all chosen to come here for a reason. And we've all chosen to come here and stay here because of that collegiality. There's the dirty secret of Charlottesville criminal justice and all criminal justice. There's about 21 people that run the whole system, and three of them are probably sitting in this room. So it's, you know, you can, Maggie can tell, I can tell, you can tell when someone comes into your office, they say, okay, I've been charged with carnal knowledge of a 14-year-old, you know, it's my neighbor's daughter. How much time am I going to get? You can tell them within 3 months of how much time they're going to get, because one of our,
well, unless I beat it.
Well, unless you beat it, which you have been known to do.
It happens from time to time.
It does. And whenever someone calls me and says, hey, man, I need a lawyer, Andre Aikes, Tucker Griffin and Barnes. By the way, we got to take a break.
Well, see, you shouldn't say that, you know, because you won't have to go to prison.
We're going
to
hold on. Can we take a break?
Yes, we can take a break.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
I can't help it. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a really defense attorney question now. Just because, you know, I'm a defense attorney, so I can't help it. But I will say, I have this same experience. It's just usually the reverse, but I have the same experience. So you're working with somebody who is a victim, right? And you're the victim witness coordinator, and so you have decided this person is the victim. Why? Because they've told you they are, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then over the course of your work with them, have you ever had anybody who you start to get the picture as the evidence develops that what they've said happened is not really what happened, and maybe they're not telling the truth. And what
the
do
only,
you do?
The one that comes most to mind, and you'll be surprised at the reason why they were, quote unquote, lying. It was an old case. It was a sex case. And she had run to the UVER and gotten an emergency, you know, got the PERC kit immediately. It's one of those things. It was the middle. She reported it was the middle of the night. Some stranger came behind me and raped me.
It was a stranger rape in the middle of the night. Wow. Right. Okay. Right. Okay. Yeah, that's dramatic. That's not something we see a lot of
in Charlottesville. Right, exactly. So like 10 years later, they get a DNA hit on the evidence, and it turns out to be somebody local. So we go to trial with it, and in the middle of the trial, it starts coming apart. Not that she did not get raped, but that she did get anally raped by this guy that she dated. But she never thought when she reported that it would catch up with that guy. She went to the UVAR because she got raped. And her, you know, she got raped. He anally raped her against her will.
Right. But it was somebody she dated.
She knew. Yeah. And she dated.
And she said when she went that she was raped by a stranger.
Because she wanted to get the services. She wasn't thinking like 10 years down the road, this guy's going to get arrested. I mean, she was. It was a trauma. So you're traumatized after this happens. Your brain does not work the way it normally works when you had a trauma. Physiologically, neurologically, your brain is in a different place. And this is, you know, we can go into all the research on the neuroscience of trauma.
I really want to talk about that.
Yeah.
But go ahead and finish this one first, and we'll get to this trauma-based investigation stuff.
So in the middle of it, you know, she starts breaking down and saying, you know, he raped me, but I didn't want to tell them that it was him because I felt embarrassed.
So she waits until the middle of trial to tell anybody?
It was a preliminary hearing, I think, is where it was coming out.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, because there's so much shame. There was so much shame around it for her.
But didn't she get prepped for the prelim? And didn't
Oh, yeah.
And then when they said, hey, we found a hit, we got a cold hit, here's the guy.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
She didn't go, oh, yeah, I used to date him, and here's what really happened.
No, she didn't. She didn't. I mean, for whatever her own reasons are.
So what happened at prelim?
It went downhill, and she was crying, you know, and and you know, obviously the prosecutor was shocked, and we're glad that that's the way it went. Obviously,
are you? I mean, I don't know.
No, I don't want anybody to go.
I mean, nobody's ever glad about how anything turns out.
No, I mean, I want the truth to come out, whatever the truth is,
right?
You know, for her. You know, obviously it was a horrible experience, and
did the guy end up not getting prosecuted because?
Yeah,
he lied too much and was going to be impeachable.
He was out after the prelim. He was
out we go.
Yeah, he was out after the prelim.
I gotcha.
Not that guy didn't have a history of other stuff.
Right.
You know, some of the other things, too. Like
things that you can't admit.
We see police reports. Like, that's our job. Every night.
You usually know more about my client than I do at the beginning of the case.
Well, yeah, because we know.
By the end of the case, I know more, but not at the beginning.
Because we've talked to his five former victims, and we know what his pattern is and things like that. So. As far as that kind of experience, that does not happen to me very often. They may leave out details because they're embarrassed of the details of it, but it's not usually like straight out lying. I have not, because for me, most of the people I work with, none of them want to be victimized. None of them would go through the entire process of being asked these horrible questions just to get somebody to go to jail. It's
so
not worth it.
Your view is basically women never lie about being raped.
I will say my view is that that is possible. But the research statistically on the what we have now is that the majority of them do not.
Tell me about the research. How did we compile statistics on this?
Well, you know, I don't have my stuff.
I know, and I didn't ask you to prep it.
Right, we're talking about Department of Justice, USDOJ, surveys and research. So, you know, that it's very rarely a false report.
Right.
It may be a report that you couldn't prosecute. It's not a false report. You know, it's not.
I just wonder how they determine that. I mean, how do the people who decide?
It's very hard
to
take. You should know this. It's very hard to get any sexual assault case to trial. Period.
Why?
Because
I mean, I try them. I don't see all.
Yes,
I don't see whatever you see before it goes. I see it when it's charged.
You don't see the massive amounts that do not get prosecuted.
Right.
Because of all the problems you would know that they are.
Because people change their minds.
Because they're shamed.
Scared.
And scared and traumatized. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they made a report to the police department, maybe their experience wasn't that good. They don't want to go forward anymore.
Oh, sure.
Or maybe when they first reported it, they said it was a red shirt. But they got interviewed the third or fourth time, and they said, oh, wait, no, it's a blue shirt.
Right.
So, you know, they want to throw the baby out with that bathwater. Well, we can't do it now. Well, the research now on the neurobiology of trauma and says people's brain do not record something the same during a trauma as if it does, like, record what you had for lunch yesterday.
We know that's true because they've done all kinds of eyewitness studies,
exactly.
Right?
And it's people, for the same thing. For the
people
same...
will have, you know, inaccurate recollections
right.
of what happened in an eyewitness case, and I imagine it's similar
right.
similar principle at work, is what
right.
you're saying.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, the correct way, there are more different ways to interview traumatized victims now. We're learning more about that and best practices.
Well, there was a recent adoption of a new statute. I think there was a House bill that was signed into mm-hmm. law by the governor that talks about, I guess, his Department of Criminal Justice Services adopting a protocol for trauma-based investigation practices.
Yes.
Have I got that right?
Yes. And
talk
I'm not,
about that.
I'm
Explain
not gonna,
what that means.
Yeah, I'm not going to pat myself on the back too much for
but
that
But you're
one.
Making the little victory sign
yes,
over here. I mean,
because
you know.
I was lucky enough to be appointed to the governor's combating sexual assault task force of last
Any
year.
Any defense counsel on that task
oh, yeah.
force?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
All right. Just checking. Checking. You know.
And, you know, my part was, you know, they divided us into part. My part was law enforcement.
Right.
So I have, over the years, been to trainings that my law enforcement partners have not been able to go to or haven't had the priority to go to, where they talk about this is how we investigate sexual assault and trauma-based incidents without mm-hmm. re-traumatizing the victim so that maybe they'll want to participate in the criminal justice system. And it's based on the neurobiology. How you ask the questions to mm-hmm. a traumatized victim is not, so what was the color of the car? What you let them tell you about it. You ask certain questions to open up certain parts of their brain, certain outlets of their brain that doesn't normally get opened up. It's more experiential. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of have to be careful because you're kind of putting them there when it happened. So what did you see? What did you smell? What did you hear? Mm-hmm. All these other things that can corroborate parts of a case. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, one of the trainings was, you know, they had a case where this woman was being raped and it was in a car and the guy was denying that it happened. And the prosecutor asked her, so what is it that you remember seeing? She goes, I remember looking at the door handle and it had like a pink piece of paint on it, you know, and it was kind of those kind of details.
Right.
Like, why would somebody make that stuff up?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not, sorry, beep. Why would somebody make that? It's just, you know,
I've been waiting for that to happen, but I was sure it was going to be me.
It wasn't a fully formed
word. No, it was a shook. Why would somebody make that? So that kind of stuff is really exciting to see that hopefully things are going to get prosecuted better. Hopefully the victim's experience are going to be better, but they have to be trained on it. When I was in that task force, that was my main goal to get this thing called the Forensic Experiential Trauma Interview. It's called the FETI, part of DCJS. There was no basic training on DCJS on how to interview a sexual assault victim.
Right.
So you have, there's no training for them. There was no training.
Sheriff's deputies somewhere who...
They go through how to, maybe they get sent to a two-day training where they...
They know how to arrest a drunk, but
Or interview an offender. And how you interview an offender and how you interview a trauma victim are two different ballparks. Mm-hmm. And they need to be trained. It's not their fault if they're not getting the training. But this DCJS, now the state is saying, you will implement this.
Well, the state says they're going to implement best practices for a lot of things, including, you know, lineups and show-ups
I agree.
That isn't happening.
Right.
So.
Well, we got to start somewhere. So, you know, if I thought that way, I would just never go to work again. If I thought that way.
Well, the best practices is happening here. I mean, Maggie and I were working on the domestic violence blueprint mapping, where we were bringing in national experts from around the country to do best practices for domestic violence intervention from everything from the 911 call to post-adjudication treatment and supervised probation. So that's in process. That's been going on, what, 4 years?
Yes.
So small parts of it are being implemented, but again, you're turning glaciers here. We're not, you know, we just can't retrain everybody at once and just say, okay, everybody from magistrates to OAR to probation to judges, you just can't change everybody at once, because all of these stakeholders all think all of their roles are very important, and they all have roles that they're very sort of entrenched in. I mean, tell a judge he's got to change or she's got to change. That takes some time.
It's difficult to tell a judge anything.
It is. In Charlottesville, we have very good judges, and we work with them every day, and they listen, and in the end, they make the decision, and we don't always agree with it, but we know that decision that they make comes from a good place because we know them as good people. And I hope that you share that. You know, I know you don't always.
I share that for most of them. There's been one or two who I.
There always are.
And, who are not on the bench anymore.
And one of the things that's hard for you, I would guess, and I know it's hard for us in probation and victim witness, is when visiting judges come in from Virginia Beach.
Yeah, you never know what you're going to get.
So how do you tell your client, you know, you're here for assault and battery, family member third, 5-year maximum, guidelines call for 6 months, you're probably going to get 6 months, and then this judge comes in and whacks him for 4 years.
Right, and it's not, you don't know it's happening until you walk into the courtroom and there's the substitute judge.
Yeah, you're like, who's this individual with the gray hair?
I wonder who this guy is.
Can I quick do some research to see what his sentencing practices are? So you just don't know,
right.
And you don't know how to tailor any of your your stuff, so that's just hard.
That's right. Yeah, that is tough. That's tougher than Commonwealth, too, I think. Sometimes the same thing happens on the other end.
It does, but the Commonwealth holds all the cards. We know that.
It's true. It's true, and I'd like very much to change that. But
well, for all of our when interns come through our office, and all of our interns, most of our interns, want to go to law school. And they're all these young, progressive, liberal, idealistic people, and I'm going to go out and I'm going to be the best defense attorney ever. Don't do it. Okay, if you want to positively and affirmatively affect the criminal justice system, be a prosecutor. You have all the power.
No. It's true. They do have all the power, but somebody's got to fight the machine. I mean, you know, somebody's got to do it. And if we don't have somebody who's doing a decent job on the other side, it's going to just become a police state.
And in Charlottesville and Albemarle, they're good folks.
They are. I have some excellent colleagues.
And we're very fortunate to work in this area. But when you go out into other areas, you know, you work where you work for a reason.
That's right. Well, and the other thing that happens is money plays a big factor, right? If you are somebody who, one of the reasons I do a lot of sex cases. I do a lot of sex cases involving kids. I do rape cases. I do UVA sex cases, lots of them. And one of the reasons I do it is because the clients can pay me. Right. If you stole a loaf of bread from Food Lion, you don't have the money to hire an attorney. Right. Now, we have a great public defender's office, but they're completely overrun and they're underpaid. And it's just not the quality of justice you get is often the quality of justice.
Justice based
yeah,
on socioeconomic memes.
You bet I am.
No way.
I know. It's shocking, isn't it?
It's shocking. It's shocking. Well, I will say, you know, from some of the stuff that we are doing locally as part of a collaboration in the criminal justice system that's been going on for 5 years, it's called this evidence-based decision-making policy team.
Jeff told me about that very early on. Talk to me about
EDM. So it came out of, they got a grant from the National Corrections Institute to implement evidence-based practices in the criminal justice system. So Charlottesville was one of 7 sites in the country that got picked. So the process, what it started out as is all these stakeholders, you know, criminal justice stakeholders sitting around a table, mapping out the criminal justice system and looking at where are the biggest gaps, where do we think things are going wrong or could go better, and then trying to find programs based on national consultants who come in and tell us this is evidence-based. This has the evidence to show that it's working.
Who are the defense attorneys involved in that team?
Jim Hensley? Jim Hensley. Mm-hmm. For years. Yeah, for 5 years.
We're about to lose Jim Hensley. He's about to retire, and that is just
it's
a
so
major
horrible.
Loss to the community.
No, yeah. He is such
should
a...
Have him on.
Yeah, you should. He'd be an interesting guy to have.
Yeah, he would be.
Yeah, I'm sure he's got lots of good stories to tell you.
Probably.
But, you know, I mean,
there's a lot of good stories he can't tell me on
right.
the air.
But that's the kind of evidence of the collaboration in Charlotte Sloan Albemarle that, frankly, doesn't happen everywhere else.
Right.
So you've got defense attorneys sitting down with the judges and the sheriff's department and the police department and probation and victim witness looking at, and we called mapping the system.
Mm-hmm.
So then we came in and saw these are the big things that are wrong at the moment that we can see. One mm-hmm. of them was probation violations that were taking up so much of the docket time. You know, people would get drug tested and have two positive drug screens, and bam, they're back in court, and it's clogging up the system, and we can't get anything done. Well, they came in and did this thing called, what is it called? Why don't you should talk about that?
It's. I'm hoping that Wendy Goodman will come on and Pat Smith will come on to talk about this, but it's the administrative response matrix. So one of our goals to address your point of sort of disparate systems is we have a matrix where if you test positive for cocaine, we put that violation in the matrix and out comes what our response to that violation should be. It doesn't ask your race. It doesn't ask your sex. It doesn't ask anything about your socioeconomic status.
It's not like the sentencing guidelines?
The sentencing guidelines, you know, those are discretionary. But our matrix, and again, Wendy and Pat should come on and talk about this, but and we also layered in risk, and well, people don't know this, but the jail population when we started this was about 535, 540 people per night.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's down, the lowest it got to is about 432. Again, Martin can tell you about that, but you know, right now it's hovering in the 460s or 470s, so we dropped.
Have to build a new jail.
Yeah, and
he did say it was down, actually, when he was on the show.
And that's because of the work that, mm-hmm. that this evidence-based decision-making task force has done. And now that's going to change a little bit because the members that are on it are, you know, Chief Longo, who's just about out the door, Colonel Sellers, Pat Smith, Jim Hensley, who's leaving, both the one of the general district court judges who I think are going to retire in 2 years. So there's going to be a lot of, you know, Denise Luncher's on it, and now Mr. Tracy's on it. So, you know, a lot of new faces are coming in, and every time, you know, new blood comes in, it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, you know, you have to catch everybody up. But new ideas are always welcome. So
changes up the mix.
Changes up. It's one of the things that we learned in this process was you don't want to mix risk. It's a little inside baseball, but you don't want to mix in treatment, mix risk levels or mix low risk with high risk. So if I have a low risk guy who's smoking marijuana, mm-hmm. I do not want to put him in a treatment group with a bunch of people that are on cocaine that are high risk or high, because you would think, you know, the optimist in us all says, well, this guy will look at the low risk guy, they'll all want to be like him. but no, the evidence shows us that the low risk guys
will get corrupted.
They'll get corrupted and gravitate toward more criminality. Mm-hmm. So that's not exactly what we want to have happen.
Okay, well, that makes sense, and I think it's about time for us to go for a break now. So we'll be right back in a few minutes.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
So, Jeff, I heard this rumor, and, you know, the rumor was that you and Maggie, at some point in the recent past, had done some things that ultimately helped disrupt a human trafficking ring.
That was all Maggie.
You want to talk to me about that? Tell me that story. That's a hot topic at the moment.
It is a hot topic. So I'm sure all of us, everyone out there listening, the thousands of listeners that we enjoy, when they turn on their computer in the morning.
Hi, Mom.
When they turn their computer on in the morning and their email pops up, there's somebody's email that's in there that you just don't want to see.
Right.
You're just like, oh, no. So when I turn my computer on in the morning and it's from Maggie Cullinan and there's like that little ampersand or asterisk that says attachment and the subject line is this the guy yours? I was like, oh, no. So that's going to be a long day. So Maggie sent me an email. There was a woman who was being human trafficked here in town. She was sort of abducted from a neighboring state, and she had some mental disease or difficulty, and was and they were keeping her on substances. And she had broken free of her captors, and somehow the Charlottesville police took a report of this lady, and she was living in a garage in Belmont, or someone's shed in Belmont that they didn't know about. So Maggie saw no real crime had been committed other than human trafficking, but the Charlottesville police were like, well, there's, you know, is it in Albemarle or is it in Charlottesville? So Maggie calls ICE, who is Homeland Security, who heads up a lot of the human trafficking stuff. And so ICE gets interested. So so they said, who do I call? So I have some trusted access into the homeless community. I used to work with Pacham quite a bit, so the homeless folks know me.
Mm-hmm.
I asked my kids as we're driving by, and these guys on the side of the road with their signs up. And Dad stops and talks to them. Dad. So I go over to the Haven. First of all, the ICE calls me, and they're over in Harrisonburg, and they're like, "We need to find this woman."
Right.
And can you find her? I said, I don't know if I can find her. I've never heard of her. So I said, all right, I'll call you back in an hour. Let me go see if I can find her. So I go over to the Haven where, you know, people, it was early in the morning, where people tend to go have breakfast who are sort of marginalized. And the Haven does great work. Hi, guys. So I go over there and I ask Herb, I said, do you know this woman? He goes, yeah, she's standing right there. So I said, well, hi, I'm Jeff. And, you know, she's obviously broken. I mean, she's broken emotionally, she's broken mentally, she's broken physically. So she doesn't know who I am.
Right.
So she's like, I was like, well, pick somebody out in here. So she picks somebody out. I call them over. I say, so I start building a rapport with her. I start building trust. So she finds three or four people that she knows that can trust me. So we go to a private spot and she starts unloading this horrendous story on me about how these guys found her in a neighboring state and were taking her from city to city and getting hotel rooms and making her service men. They were running ads on the internet. So this is all happening in about a 45-minute period. So I call ICE back and I get the agent on the phone, and she's sort of frustrated with me. She's like, no, I need to talk to the lady. I don't want to talk to you again. I go, all right. So I hand her
the phone.
Here she is. And she's like, how did you find her? I said, I don't know. Leave me alone. So anyway, ICE comes over from Harrisonburg and they snatch her up and return her to her family. And so she was concerned because she was on the run, because if these guys wanted her back, because she was their meal ticket. I mean, she was making them probably $1,000 bucks a day. And the story she told me is probably a little bit too horrific and graphic to talk about on the air. But that was an impactful time. That was a hard day.
Did those guys end up getting found and prosecuted?
I never got subpoenaed, so I don't know. As you work in federal court much?
Not much.
Yeah,
used
probably
to years ago, but I like to win every now and then. So,
so you know, the feds, they're a need to know basis. You know, if they need you, they come find you. If they don't need you, they're not gonna reach
but
out.
But in any event, you helped to get her back.
We did. Maggie started it, and you know, and that's what she does every morning. Is she goes through every police report that comes through, and mines it. And because of her experience in our office, a lot of the names are fairly similar. And you know, she'll call over, and one of the things that Maggie does that is her counseling background helps is, you know, the victims are, one of the things I tell victims is no one can, or people in general, is no one can ever tell a victim how to be a victim. They run the gamut. So, right? So this lady will come in and some guy will have stolen her wallet out of her purse at Harris Teeter. And before she realized her wallet was gone, he had gone to Best Buy and bought $10,000 worth of electronics. So she comes in, or $500. So she comes into Maggie's office and says, I want this guy to go to prison for life. That's not going to happen. Okay. So it's
right.
Maggie tries to meet these victims where they are. And, you know, she tries to set realistic expectations of what the criminal justice is going to provide for that person.
Right.
So
a little reality counseling.
It is.
Yeah, there's a lot of reality counseling in criminal defense,
yes,
too.
Yes.
And then the, on the other side of the victimization is some of the victims come in and just say, I don't want anything to happen. You know,
right.
I want him to get treatment. But you know, this is his 15th domestic assault and battery. The chances of him getting some prison time are probably pretty significant. But I don't want that to happen. So then she's got to, you know, set realistic expectations.
How do you deal with that, Maggie? What do you do when you have a victim, particularly in a domestic violence situation? I know this happens where, you know, the person reports it the night of or the next day, right? And they're all fired up and they want to do something about it. And then by the time you get to the court, they've changed their mind. What do you say to them? How do you counsel those people?
Well, I respect where they are. You know, we know statistically it takes 8 to 10 times of leaving an abusive relationship for them to actually be able to separate themselves. Mm-hmm. So at the time that I see them, they may be in their first attempt or second attempt or 10th attempt. You know, my response to them has to be the same always. Mm-hmm. And mostly in those kind of cases, I understand where you are. You know, I understand why you love this person. You didn't know they would do this when you were with them. You're sure they're going to change. You know, if you love them, they will change. And you don't want to break up the family. You may need that person for support. So I kind of recognize mm-hmm. and empathy. Empathy is a big name in what I do. Mm-hmm. It's putting yourself in that person's position, which is sometimes hard because in your head, you're like, oh my God, this is, you know, crazy. And tell them. And mostly we talk to them about safety. Okay, so you're going to go back. I just want to let you know. If something happens again, we say these incredibly stupid things that we have to tell them, like, stay out of the kitchen because there's knives there. If you feel a fight coming on, stay out of the kitchen. Stay out of the bathroom because it's enclosed space with hard spaces. You know, if you have to leave, hide a key. Get some of your stuff together, your social security cards, your birth certificates, in case you have to leave immediately.
Right.
You know, get a signal.
You basically help them do some extraction planning
exactly,
for the future.
Exactly. So I'm giving them information so that, and in trying to empower them to do what they need to do. The whole
right.
thing with domestic violence is that their power is being taken away.
Right.
You know, if it's domestic violence 101, it's not about the hitting. It's about the controlling behavior of the offender over the victim. So we don't want to tell her, and sometimes the criminal justice system does say that, well, you must participate.
Right.
Because they've already been told by their offender, you must do this, you can't do that.
Right.
So the idea is to try to empower them with information. If the more information they have, and the more people kind of say to them, listen, I'm really worried about your safety. You know, I hear what you're saying, but I'm worried about you. I'm worried about your kids. So, you know, if you need help, we're still going to be here whether you cooperated with prosecution or not. Because mm-hmm. that's our job, to be there for the victim whether they cooperate or not.
Right.
We talk to plenty of people who never end up, you know, going through a criminal justice
right.
system.
Sure.
So our job is just to try to help them save their lives.
How does the system deal with a victim who changes their story? If you've got a woman, because it's usually a woman, let's just be fair,
mm-hmm.
Who basically says, my boyfriend beat the ever-loving heck out of me. And then by the time you get to court, that person has changed their story. Well, that's not exactly what happened, or I don't remember what happened, or, you know, actually it was my fault, or,
right.
you know, and the facts that they're testifying or would be testifying to are different than what they said. What happens? I mean, does the prosecutor prosecute those people for false report to police
no.
officers?
No, because that's counterproductive.
Right.
Because if you prosecute...
But some jurisdictions,
some jurisdictions
used to do that.
Well, you know, then you end up with dead victims who don't right. call the police the next time.
Right.
So, I mean, they have to walk a fine line. I mean, they have a job to do. And if the victim doesn't want to participate, they will do everything they can to not make the victim participate, to either use the photos or excited mm-hmm, utterances mm-hmm, or other mm-hmm. technical legal things that
right.
they can try to use, or have another witness who saw it,
mm-hmm.
and then that victim doesn't have to testify at
right.
all.
Right, that
might,
makes sense.
You know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, we do the best we can with what we have, and just recognize the dynamic. And the more you know about the dynamic, you know, the more you can kind of understand it and deal with it. Doesn't make it any less frustrating.
And that represents
know.
Kind of a shift in the system, though. I mean, it strikes me that it used to be more prevalent that you'd hear that, you know, the prosecutor just had it up to here with this woman who changed her story 15 times, and by God, she was either going to testify or they were going to prosecute her. And
yeah.
I don't see that anymore.
You do not. You do not. I mean, I worked at the shelter for 4 years as a legal advocate, and that was, God, 20 years ago, maybe?
Old.
Yeah. So, and that is where I first witnessed Andre Hake's prosecuting
Uh-oh.
Cases in Fluvanna.
Uh-oh.
When you were an intern. Do you remember
Don't
that?
Don't say that.
Yes, you actually
I
were.
I never prosecuted.
Yes,
no,
yes.
No.
I was there.
It's
I witnessed
true.
It. So, I mean, it's just taken the dynamic, understanding that a dynamic is just takes a long time. You know, change
yeah.
is slow. And it's coming. And it's getting better. You know, and that's the only way you can stay in this job, if you think that you can do things to make it better.
Well, tell me your favorite story about someone that you helped, Maggie. Tell me, you know, mm-hmm. when you felt like you had the most impact in helping someone.
Oh, well, we had a case where as a juvenile, she was a teenager and got sexually assaulted at UVA in the hospital in a room. She was seeing her uncle there.
You mean she was not a patient in the hospital. No. She was a guest in the hospital when someone sexually assaulted her.
Yes.
Okay.
As a result of that sexual assault, she got pregnant.
Oh.
She had the baby. It was a mixed race baby. She was actually from a southwestern part of the state. It's basically a hole. I mean, there's nothing there.
I'm from down there. Which hole is
it? I don't remember at the time.
There's a lot of holes down there.
Yes, it was really bad. And we dealt with her through her
I can't imagine
her grandmother.
Somebody from that end of the state then having a mixed race child
was not going
to
well
deal with in that community. Oh.
Yeah, well, not that was not going for it. But also her grandmother had custody of her and her siblings, and her grandmother was a major racist. And so she had all sorts of problems with trying to prosecute it. And we had trouble getting to interview her. They didn't want, her grandma didn't want us coming to the house for some reason. So we tried to set up, and they kept defaulting and defaulting and defaulting on trying to set up an interview so we could get the details of it. And to the point where she would call me and say, "Grandma doesn't let me go anywhere. Grandma doesn't let me talk to anybody. She's homeschooled. Grandma knows everybody at DSS, so even if I tried to report being abused, and I have, nothing would happen."
Oh, I see.
So we didn't know the extent of it until she got to trial, and it was a trial date, and she brought the baby, and she had forgotten or didn't bring enough food.
She brought the baby to trial.
Well, because she didn't have any, you know, the whole
Grandma
family, the whole clan.
Watch the baby.
Right, the whole clan came in.
Oh, okay, so they came with her.
Oh,
so
yeah.
She didn't have the baby on the stand or anything.
No. It was, you know, it was in the courthouse.
Right.
And she forgot to bring formula. She didn't think it was going to be that long. So she went and got an orange soda and put it in a bottle and gave it to the child. And the child had no food. They didn't bring food. So cousin went out and got some Cheetos.
Oh, my God.
So that was happening. And then, but I was sitting with her because we were waiting. They were trying to work out a plea. And so I was sitting and I was sitting there listening to more and more stories about how they couldn't sleep in a bed because grandma didn't want the bed. Grandma had OCD. They would have to sleep in chairs every night. They were not allowed to go outside. They were not allowed to go outside because if they tracked in dirt. I mean, it was bizarre. And she wasn't getting any homeschooling at all.
A lot of mental health issues.
Grandma, yeah. But the kid had no resources. So after that, I wrote a letter, and Claude Worrell, who's our judge, wrote a letter to the head of DSS and outlined everything that happened. And I said, you know, if something doesn't happen here, you know, we're going to make some noise at the state level that you will not like. Right after that, they went in. They saw the house. They heard more horror stories. And that kid and her baby got yanked out and went into social services with her little sister. You know, so they were in a better place. She eventually went to school. She was happy going to school. That's as far as I know about that.
She was allowed to sleep in a bed and go outside?
Yeah. Yeah. So those are kind of stories that kind of stick with me.
Wow, orange soda and Cheetos.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and there's always the sexual assault victim that who's a kid who comes in to see me. The case was like 5 years ago, and it was against her father, and he went to jail. But every once in a while, she'll walk into my office, tell me how she's doing, give me a hug, ask about the prosecutor who's not in the office anymore, and tell me about her life. You know, so those kind of things.
So it's got to feel good that you get to.
They're few and far between, but yes,
that way.
They are there. Yeah.
See, I get to feel good when I win.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes it's kind of a mixed bag.
A mixed bag of winning, isn't it? Depending on who's the other side.
But,
yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, well, thank you so much for coming and talking to
my
us
pleasure.
About this today. And thank you, Mr. Leonard, for consenting to be on my radio show.
And thank you for everything you do. You, your show on this station is spectacular. And you can't walk around Court Square without people. I can't walk around Court Square without people telling me how great your show is. And I really appreciate you being here.
Well, this is 94.7 WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You have been listening to Straight Talk, which is a local program dealing with law and social justice issues affecting our community. Tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. We'll be speaking with Afton Bradley about trans healthcare issues. I'm Andre Hakes, signing off for Straight Talk. Have a great weekend.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hayes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.